You are listening to a sermon by Janet Bolt, recorded on Sunday, October 27, 2013, at the Point Grey Interminonite Fellowship in Vancouver, British Columbia. The opinions expressed by the speaker are not necessarily those of the church. This recording is licensed for personal use by individuals only and may not be copied, broadcast, or redistributed without the prior permission of the church board. For more information, please visit our website at www.pgimf.org.
So I've entitled my talk this morning, Clasping of Hands. When I first read the lectionary text for this week, three things came to mind. The first was the old conundrum, who's on first? The second was a poem by George Herbert entitled Clasping of Hands. And the third was the song, Put Your Hand in the Hand of the Man from Galilee. My mind went to who's on first. Why? Because some of the texts, in my mind at least, pose a bit of a conundrum. The language is confusing. Who is doing what when? And this took me to a study I did while at Regent on Herbert's poem, Clasping of Hands, because Herbert playfully confuses language so that we don't know who takes the initiative and who responds. And the third idea, put your hand in the hand, flowed from Herbert's poem. So today's study on the lectionary will counterpoint these ideas and ruminate a bit on a riddle. I'd like to have Joel chapter 2 read out loud, if somebody would like to do that. 2:23-32. Yeah, go ahead, Rosie. Thanks.
O children of Zion, be glad and rejoice in the Lord your God, for he has given the early rain for your vindication. He has poured down for you abundant rain, the early and the later rain, as before. The threshing floor shall be full of grain. The vats shall overflow with wine and oil. I will repay you for the years that the swarming locust has eaten, the hopper, the destroyer, and the cutter, my great army which I sent against you. You shall eat in plenty and be satisfied, and praise the name of the Lord your God, who has dealt wondrously with you. And my people shall never again be put to shame. You shall know that I am in the midst of Israel, and that I, the Lord, am your God, and there is no other. And my people shall never again be put to shame. Then afterwards I will pour out my spirit on all flesh. Your sons and your daughters shall prophesy. Your old men shall dream dreams, and your young men shall see visions. Even on the male and female slaves in those days I will pour out my spirit. I will show portents in the heavens and on the earth, blood and fire and columns of smoke. The sun shall be turned to darkness and the moon to blood, before the great and terrible day of the Lord comes. Then everyone who calls on the name of the Lord shall be saved. For in Mount Zion and in Jerusalem there shall be those who escape, as the Lord has said, and among the survivors shall be those whom the Lord calls.
Thank you, Rosie. I appreciate how you read that. I want the text sort of to speak for themselves today, so it's lovely to have you. I found this to be a beautiful passage of restoration. Be glad. Be not afraid. Never again will my people be shamed. I will repay you for all the years the locusts have eaten. This is a very appropriate text for Reformation Sunday. Former things will pass away, and new things will come. Shame will disappear and be replaced with wonder and acceptance. There will be deliverance, as the Lord has said. Now I'd like to have Psalm 65 read. Yeah, thanks.
Praise is due to you, O God in Zion, and to you shall vows be performed, O you who answer prayer. To you all flesh shall overcome. When deeds of iniquity overwhelm us, you forgive our transgressions. Happy are those whom you choose and bring near to live in your courts. We shall be satisfied with the goodness of your house, your holy temple. By awesome deeds you answer us with deliverance, O God of our salvation. You are the hope of all the ends of the earth and of the farthest seas. By your strength you establish the mountains. You are girded with might. You silence the roaring of the seas, the roaring of the waves, the tumult of the peoples. Those who live at the earth's farthest bounds are awed by your signs. You make the gateways of the morning and the evening shout for joy. You visit the earth and water it. You greatly enrich it. The river of God is full of water. You have provided the people with grain, for so you have prepared it. You water its furrows abundantly, settling its ridges, softening it with showers, and blessing its growth. You crown the year with your bounty. Your wagon tracks overflow with richness. The pastures of the wilderness overflow. The hills gird themselves with joy. The meadows clothe themselves with flocks. The valleys deck themselves with grain. They shout and sing together for joy.
That could be enough, couldn't it? Mm-hmm. That's a powerful, powerful passage, and on a beautiful day like this in the autumn season. So Psalm 65 further picks up this theme. This psalm focuses on God's sustaining involvement in the world. God is revealed as both a powerful and an intimate creator. In theological terms, God is both transcendent, beyond creation, and immanent, immersed in creation and all the nitty-gritty details. God transcends time and space, but is also very present to humanity. So these passages reveal a God who cares for the land and the people and provides for all their needs. The psalmist stresses with strong verbs how God is a continuous actor and agent in the world. With generosity and strength, God's creation continues year after year to bring forth needed sustenance. Psalm 65 also describes God's active involvement in the goings-on in the city, in the midst of political and social upheaval, and in the midst of finite humanity. At the heart of Israel's faith was a deep conviction that all of life was sustained by God's breathing. At the same time, Psalm 65 reflects on human responsibility in conjunction with God's immanence. Fallible human beings are called somehow to participate in God's imminent work of recreation and reformation. God's generous initiative and humanity's dependence are to work together like partners in the circle dance. World events threaten to make this dance a joke at times. Those without food and drought-stricken lands, and those whose lives were shattered by tsunamis, would have difficulty in believing God's active role of generosity in creation. People whose lives have forever been altered by human violence, like my friend Lois, whose husband was brutally executed 6 years ago by gang members, and like the families and friends of those who were traumatized and killed recently at the Westgate Mall in Kenya. These would have difficulty in believing God's initiative meets with intimate human response. How do we make sense of God's transcendence and immanence, God's actions and human actions in light of these events? Passages like Joel 2 and Psalm 65 emerged from times of such uncertainty and injustice. Here the writers found comfort in reiterating God's actions in creation and God's responsiveness to humanity. There's a term in philosophy called symbiosis, which is reflected, I think, in these passages. Symbiosis is a relationship, or the living together, of two dissimilar organisms. The relationship may be beneficial to both, or beneficial to one without effect on the other, or one where it's detrimental to the other. In these passages, God and humankind are in a symbiotic relationship, a living dance of connection. Is it beneficial to both? Or does God's initiative have no effect on God? Is it beneficial? Does God benefit from being in relationship with humanity? Or does only humanity benefit? George Herbert, I believe, was considering this symbiotic conundrum when he wrote Clasping of Hands, a short poem in his lengthy book of poems called The Temple. Written in 1633, this collection of 170 poems contribute to an understanding of one person or the other in the divine-human relationship. Throughout The Temple, Herbert uses mine-thine language to identify this relationship. But in clasping of hands, he uses a concentrated form of this, like a prism. It could be turned over and over and held up to the light to reveal more and more angles. And trust me, I did this for one of my papers and could not mind the depth of it. I'd like to read Clasping of Hands for you, or at least attempt. You have a copy in your bulletin if you'd like to read along. The language is playful. This poem is a conundrum. It's a perplexing riddle. Clasping of Hands by George Herbert. Lord, thou art mine, and I am thine, if mine I am, and thine much more than I, or ought, or can be mine. Yet to be thine doth me restore, so that again I now am mine, and with advantage mine the more. Since this being mine brings with it thine, and thou with me dost thee restore. If I without thee would be mine, I neither should be mine nor thine. Lord, I am thine and thou art mine, so mine thou art, that something more I may presume thee mine than thine. For thou didst suffer to restore not thee, but me, and to be mine, and with advantage mine the more, since thou in death wast none of thine. Yet then as mine didst me restore. O be mine still, still make me thine, or rather make no thine and mine. Herbert uses the title Clasping of Hands to describe his play on the words I mine and thee thine. Hands clasped have been used in various ways in making a promise or an oath, as in a pledge of marriage. Clasping in the Oxford English Dictionary is defined as grasping, embracing, enclosing. Anne Slater, in writing about this poem, commented that the dominant rhyme words of mine, thine, created a kind of stanza equivalent of the interlaced fingers of man's hand clasped in God's. Less like a handshake, more like an embrace. For me, the lectionary text read like this. The interlacing of humanity's actions with that of God's, clasping of hands as in a pledge or a promise, or a dance where both partners sense and respond to each other's movements. Age-old questions come to mind when I read passages like this. What part of the dance is ours, and what is God's? There appears to be a symbiotic relationship between God's loving initiative and human responsibility. Yet, like Herbert's poem, it remains a conundrum. It can't easily be pinned down to cause and effect. Paul's passage in 2 Timothy, seen through this lens, articulates this back and forth rhythm as well. Would somebody like to read 2 Timothy passage? There's two short passages there. Thank you.
And for me, I am already being poured out as a libation, and the time of my departure has come. I fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. From now on, there is reserved for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord, the righteous judge, will give to me on that day, and not only to me, but also to all who have longed for his appearing. At my first defense, no one came to my support, but all deserted me. May it not be counted against them, but the Lord stood by me and gave me strength, so that through me the message might be fully proclaimed and all the Gentiles might hear it. So I was rescued from the lion's mouth. The Lord will rescue me. From every evil attack, and save me for his heavenly kingdom. To him be the glory forever and ever. Amen.
So Paul writes, I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. Now there's in store for me a crown of righteousness, which the Lord will award to me. The Lord stood at my side and gave me strength. The Lord will rescue me from every evil attack and bring me safely to his heavenly kingdom. For me, the language dances back and forth between God's initiative and Paul's activity, so it's kind of hard to tell who's on first. Now we come to the last lectionary text, a familiar one, a story of contrast between a leading religious authority and an obvious sinner. So Luke chapter 18, we'd like to read that. Thank you.
He also told this parable to some who trusted in themselves that they were righteous and regarded others with contempt. Two men went up to the temple to pray, one a Pharisee and the other a tax collector. The Pharisee, standing by himself, was praying thus, God, I thank you that I am not like other people, thieves, rogues, adulterers, or even like this tax collector. I fast twice a week. I give a tenth of all my income. But the tax collector, standing far off, would not even look up to heaven, but was beating his breast and saying, God, be merciful to me, a sinner. I tell you, this man went down to his home justified rather than the other, for all who exalt themselves will be humbled, but all who humble themselves will be exalted.
Mm-hmm. Thank you. This passage reminds us that although there is this intimate divine-human dance, there's still a distinction between the goodness of God and the fallenness of humanity. In this parable, I think we have a fascinating and perplexing riddle of sorts. The Pharisee is sure of his status before God. He knows exactly what was required of him by law, and he has worked hard to fulfill every bit of it. In his prayer, this unnamed religious leader lists his good deeds with the assurance of acceptance. He knows his responsibility as a follower of God, and he is confident that he has fulfilled them. I fast twice a week, more than I do. I give a tenth of all my income. We can imagine him mouthing the words of Psalm 65. I have made vows to God and fulfilled them. I have come to you in prayer. I have lived in your courts. I have been filled with the good things from your house. Or he could just as easily be speaking as Paul spoke in 2 Timothy. I have fought the good fight. I have finished the race. I have kept the faith. There's a crown of righteousness waiting for me. So why is the Pharisee's prayer not accepted? He is seemingly fulfilling his part of the symbiotic relationship, and he's expecting a benevolent response. The unnamed tax collector, on the other hand, has no good deeds to recount. He is a fraudulent government official, typically a foreigner, a wealthy man who gouged the poor. The writer of this passage assumes that we know what kind of man this tax collector is and how neglectful he is of right actions, of doing his part of the relationship. Why is his prayer accepted when he has not been doing those things which so clearly seem to guarantee status for the religious leader? A leader who knows the law and meticulously tries to obey it, somehow fails to get it right, while an obvious renegade is honored. Jesus' listeners must have been surprised at this reversal, even as we are. How do we make sense of this riddle? The text suggests that what made the difference revolved around awareness. The Pharisee's prayer includes no confession, no supplication. He asks nothing of God. He already has everything he needs. He has exceeded the standard requirements at every single point. He imagines he has good ground on which to stand before God, ground other than God's mercy. The tax collector, standing far away, doesn't even lift his eyes to heaven, but beats his breast in a gesture of extreme anguish. His prayer is simple and direct, asking only for God's mercy. The tax collector brings no personal achievements or earned righteousness to the table to bargain with God. His only virtue is humility. Now, Karl Barth believed that both men were equally shamed before God, but that the religious leader did not recognize his shame, while the tax collector did. The shame was a result, according to Barth, of their sin. Neither one was immune. But this is a story of reversal, because while the one knew himself to be justified by his good deeds, it is the one who knew himself to be a failure who went home justified. This is the key word of this passage, justified. Justification is all about how we are ever able to experience a relationship with a good and generous God. How are we ever to be accepted? How our responses to God's initiative are ever to be welcomed? Justification is about God reaching out and us reaching back, a clasping of hands across a human divide. Simply put, one man honestly thought he could, by doing enough, earn God's acceptance. One man honestly knew he could not. One asked for justification by listing his part of the bargain. The other begged God's mercy without excuse. God's grace was available to both, but could be received only by the one who understood his need of it. The relationship had to be a gift, or there would be none of it. How do we wrap this up? How can we? Like Herbert's poem, perhaps the riddle will remain. We cannot describe this human-divine relationship without reverting to circular, symbiotic language. Fallible human beings are called somehow to participate in God's imminent work of recreation and reformation. God's justice and mercy involve human requirement. Yet the dance can only happen at God's initiative. At Columbia Bible College, I co-teach a class on the classic spiritual disciplines. One of our challenges has been to help students grasp that the course is not about learning a whole lot of new tasks in order to earn God's favor or in order to make them holy. We don't want to graduate from the college a whole round of new Pharisees who look for justification through their own behavior. So it's a challenge. So one of our main goals in this course, and one we reiterate over and over and put on our exams, and they still don't get it right, is this. Spiritual disciplines are simply a way to place ourselves before God so that God can transform us. This is what the tax collector understood, that God is the one who generously creates and transforms, and that what is called for from us is the humility to come in contrition and dependence and trust. God initiates, we respond. And in this way, through our acknowledgement of shame and our reliance on God's generosity, shame will disappear and be replaced with wonder and acceptance. This takes us back to our very first passage from Joel. Then you will know that I am the Lord your God, and there is no other. Never again will my people be shamed. There will be deliverance, as the Lord has said. Perhaps this is the story of shame and deliverance that Jean McClelland, Canadian singer and songwriter from Prince Edward Island, was trying to articulate back in 1970 when he wrote the song, Put Your Hand in the Hand. And I'd like to invite my husband to come up and share a little bit about the song and to sing that for us.
In the early 1980s, while working for Global Television as a program coordinator, I met Gene McClelland. I had invited him to sing for the local portion of the Temi Telethon and also to talk about his faith journey on Trinity Television. I had never met him before, and I was surprised to meet a shy, retiring man with an eye patch on one eye and looking rather lost in the studio. I didn't know that he had had polio when he was young, nor did I know of his long and painful journey that led to his ultimate conversion. I liked him instantly, and we made time to go for lunch and spend an afternoon together. And I had discovered that he was a prolific songwriter and had written well over 100 songs by then. He didn't like the limelight, however, and only performed because that was how he made an income. Some of you might actually remember him from the Don Messer's Jubilee. I don't know if you ever watched television. He was a regular there on that show. And he was thrilled when Anne Murray picked up on several of his songs and recorded them, receiving a Juno for song, what was it called, Snowbird, in the process. Because what it did, it took the spotlight off of him. He had a deep faith journey, but he struggled with depression and ultimately couldn't overcome it. And in 1995, he chose to suicide at his home in PEI. We were friends. He was only trying to find his way home to God. I believe he found it. He left a permanent impression on me, and I would like to sing this song that he wrote in honor of this shy and unassuming man. I'm also going to sing it the way he wrote it. It was actually taken and written and sung differently by some of the bands that changed some of the words. So I actually got the original. And so if it sounds a little different, that's why. This is how he actually only used a guitar for it, too, so. Put your hand in the hand of the man who stilled the water. Put your hand in the hand of the man who calmed the sea. Take a look at yourself, and you can look at others differently. Putting your hand in the hand of the man from Galilee. Every time I look into the holy book, I want to tremble. When I read about the carpenter's son who played the temple. For them buyers and them sellers were no different fellers than I profess to be. And it causes me shame to know I'm not the man that I'd like to be. Put your hand in the hand of the man who stilled the water. Put your hand in the hand of the man who calmed the sea. Take a look at yourself, and you can look at others differently. Put in your hand of the man of the man from Galilee. Mama taught me how to read before I reached the age of 7. And when I'm down on my knees, that's when I'm close to heaven. Well, Daddy lived his life with 2 kids and a wife, and you gotta do what you must do. And he showed me enough to see what I gotta get to get me through. Blew that a little bit. Put your hand in the hand of the man. You wanna sing it? Put your hand in the hand of the man who calmed the sea. Take a look at yourself, and you can look at others differently. Putting your hand in the hand of the man from Galilee. Let's sing that chorus again. Put your hand in the hand of the man who stayed in the water. Put your hand in the hand of the man who calmed the sea. Take a look at yourself, and you can look at others differently. Put your hand in the hand of the man from Galilee. Take a look at yourself, and you can look at others differently. Put your hand in the hand of the man from Galilee.